we seen that a direct parallel is Psalm 130, verses 1 to 2, where David says, "Out of the depths I cry to thee, O Lord. Hear my voice, let thy ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications." And so the first verse has to do with God as our relief in times of distress. You've seen that David begins with a prayer, "Answer me." Now, it's in the imperative. It's a command. David really does want a response, and the response will make all the difference in his life. Now, he addresses the psalm to the God of my righteousness, and that's a Hebrew way of saying that my righteous God. And so that's the way that the Hebrews speak, my God of righteousness, my righteous God. Now, righteousness, as we've seen many times before, is a covenant term. It means to be in conformity to the covenant, and so God is faithful to the covenant, his side of it, and then we are faithful to our side of it, and in both cases, there is righteousness. And so what David is praying is that God would vindicate him as one who has kept the covenant over against those who are accusing him of failing to keep faith. And so David's opponents really didn't care very much about the facts of the matter, didn't care very much about the truth. Very much like modern individuals are, of course. If we don't want to believe something, we're not going to. Or if we want to believe it, we're going to as well. That seems to be especially so in the realm of politics. And so, there's nothing new under the sun, to be sure. And so, they're accusing him of failing to keep faith with God when in fact he has done so. And so, Psalm 4 is like a group of psalms where the phrase is used, "according to my righteousness." Now, that's not a cynical statement, but rather, David, in spite of all of his sins, was still one who loved God and honored his will, and so he could pray according to my righteousness. And we see that his prayer was based on God's mercies in the past. He said, "Thou hast given me room when I was in distress." That word distress means to be in a tight spot. David was hemmed in with no apparent way of escape. And the perfect example of that is Psalm 3, where his enemies are all around him. And so wherever David then could look, you would find those who were out after his head. And so he really is hemmed in a tight place. He is suffering distress. And then he goes on to say that when in a tight spot, you got me out. So he's been in these tight spots before, but every time God rescued him. And we'll see examples from Paul by the end of the lesson. Well, then apart from this cry for an answer, the psalm contains two other petitions. "Be gracious to me and hear my prayer." The word and the concept of grace really gets off the ground in Exodus. Exodus 33 and 34. The background is the golden calf incident of 32. And we know that Moses comes down from the mountain. He sees that Israel had risen up to play. They were engaging in an orgy. And so in anger, throws down the tablets of the law. And consequently, there were a number of them, of the Israelites, who were killed. But the majority remained. And so it is that God had mercy on whom he had mercy. He was compassionate toward whom he would exercise compassion. Paul quotes that in Romans 9. And so, "Be gracious, and then hear my prayer." And it's not just to hear in the sense that you understand the sound of the words, but it means to respond. Hearing in Scripture always means to respond. Deuteronomy 6:4, that's called the Shema. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." And so it's not just simply acknowledging that God is one, but it means to act in light of the fact that he is the only God, that he is the only creator. Well, then, we come now to David's cry of complaint in verse 2. He says, "O important people, how long shall my honor suffer reproach? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies?" All right, so then David names his enemies sons of a man. And again, that's a Hebrew way of speaking. It sounds rather strange to us. But the idea is that of important people, and mainly the rich. You know from Psalm 73 that the rich are the wealthy of Israel, but they're also the wicked of Israel. They put themselves in the place of God, as it were, as Lord and Judge. And in the prophets, we read that the rich are those who are self-satisfied. They have no need of the Lord. But the poor have no choice but to trust in God. And so Jesus finally can say in Matthew 5, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." So David cries out, how long? And the complaint with regard to those important people has one specific point of reference. He says, "How long shall my honor suffer reproach? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies?" Now, there are 3 points there. One is David's honor. Now, that could be anyone's honor, but especially his as the king. The enemies had no respect for the office of king, at least not David as the king. And that very often is the case even in modern politics, where perhaps you can respect the office, but you don't respect the person holding the office at all. And that's all too common, I'm afraid. And so we have to put up with it for the time being until there's another election, and maybe we can do something about it. But the enemies had no respect for David whatsoever. And by implication, of course, they had no regard for anyone who was not part of their company. And so it's us four and no more, as it were. Then next, there's the love of vain words. Now, vain words are those who have no substance about them. They're superficial. They're just made up for the occasion. And so you throw anything against the wall and see if it'll stick. You know. And so that's what they were doing. That's what continues to happen today. That truth doesn't really matter. It's what we can, get out of it for ourselves. And then thirdly, they seek or they run after lies. What that means is that they expend their energy on falsehood, not the truth. See, just the opposite of David in Psalm 119, where he says, "I will run in the way of thy commandments when you enlarge my understanding." Now, that's an intensification of the notion of walking. And so to walk with the Lord means to say that we have fellowship with him and we do what he says. We're in keeping with the covenant. Well, David then intensifies the idea and says that I will run in the way of your commandments. And again, Paul quotes that in Romans 9. All right, well, now we come to verses 3 through 5, where David has 6 imperatives or commands that he directs to these important people. So he says, "But know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Be angry, but do not sin." Now, where have you seen that elsewhere?
Do not let the sun go down upon your anger.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, from Ephesians. We'll look at that in just a bit. Yeah. "Be angry, but do not sin. Ponder with your own heart on your deeds and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord." All right, so then you have these imperatives. Know, tremble, ponder, be silent, sacrifice, and trust. And so they are addressed now to David's enemies. And there I need to make a modification from something we said last week. That David is addressing those who superficially or formally are within the covenant community, and yet they're living at variance with the covenant itself. And so they're in the covenant, you might say, but not of the covenant. So just to take those in order, and the first one is no. Now, that word is always a combination of thought and action. Now, for us, in English anyway, and in the modern world, we can know something, but that's the end of it. And actually, the Greeks as well, they have the same notion, that if you know something, you study it, you look at it, you analyze it, you can sort of dance around it, see it from various angles, but you don't necessarily have to act in light of what you perceive. And so trying to be scientifically objective, so to speak. And of course, there is no such thing as complete objectivity because we all work with assumptions, a set of assumptions. But in Hebrew thinking, there's always this combination of thought and action. There's no distinction between head knowledge and heart knowledge. Not in Scripture. And so to know that God has set apart the godly is to conduct ourselves in such a way that we do what we were meant to do. That we act according to the reason we've been set apart. Now, according to the text, we know a couple of things. One is that the Lord has set apart the godly or the faithful for himself. Now, that word godly, that's one that really takes off during the period of the Maccabees, a couple of centuries before the New Testament. And the gist of it is that the Syrians had come down and had taken over Israel There was a king called Antiochus Epiphanes IV, and he's the one who tried to impose Greek ways on Israel and was able to succeed for a while. But the godly, in Hebrew, the Hasidim, we know about the Hasidic Jews, don't we? And so they dress in such a way and act in such a way, very strict, very orthodox. Well, that word Hasidic comes from the Hebrew word Hasidim, which means those who are loyal to the covenant, those who live by the covenant. And so the Lord has marked them out for himself, and he won't abandon them to the wicked. Now in Psalm 32, David draws upon that very word, the godly. He says, let the godly pray. Now, Psalm 32 is what kind of a psalm, do we say? It's a famous psalm. Of course, Paul quotes it in Romans 4. Now, 32 and 51 and a couple of others as well. What's the content of a psalm like that? And in particular, Psalm 32. What's the occasion? I'm sorry?
Repentance.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So the background, of course, is the incident with Bathsheba and the subsequent events after that. And so it's David's penitential psalm. And he says, let the godly pray. Now, from a certain point of view, that may seem to be very astounding because David had been anything but godly. The adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah the Hittite. And it's very interesting that when Hollywood does something on David and Bathsheba, of course they play up the adultery angle because that's titillating and all that. But in point of fact, when you read the narrative in 2 Samuel, what the writer singles out more than anything else is the murder of Uriah. Spends a lot more time on that. And you get insight in David's very last psalm, where he talks about the king as the one who is blessed when he rules over men in righteousness. That's what the king was meant to do. But David was anything but that at this time. But even so, the Lord dealt with him. He returned. He repented. And he still is one of the godly. He can call himself or rank himself among the godly because he hasn't forsaken the covenant. And that's the important thing. See, we can sin. We can sin grievously. We can mess up really badly. All of us can. But the Lord deals with us. It's like David in Psalm 3, the lifter up of my head. So our heads can be bowed down with shame and degradation, and yet he comes and lifts it up again so that we come to understand or be reminded that life is still worth living. We can go on. And we still are the Lord's own. He's dealt with us and we're his. I am his and he is mine. All right, so that's one thing to about this knowledge, knowing. Then he says as well, the Lord hears when I call to him. And again, that's an echo of Psalm 3, which is why these two psalms are back to back. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. Now, as we pointed out in going through Psalm 3, that was a pretty dangerous thing for David to do. Because no doubt there were enemies, some of them, who knew the sound of his voice. And there are times when a whispered prayer may be appropriate, but that was not one of them. So David had to cry out. And having done so, he was able to lie down and sleep, and he woke up again because the Lord sustained him. Now, the verb tenses reflect the morning after the threat. One writer says, God has sustained him through the night so that now with confidence rooted in rest, he can look forward to another day in the presence of a God who sustains. And so often times of blessing come just in the ordinary events of life. And it's not just, you know, you get a good night's sleep and things look better in the morning. That may be true, but in David's case, though, he knows that the nighttime brought a special kind of threat because he was able at nighttime to slip into Saul's camp and cut off a portion of his garment. Well, one of those enemies They wouldn't be after a piece of cloth. They would be after plunging the knife in his heart. But the Lord sustained him. And so he awoke the next day, understanding that in spite of what he had done and what he had become, he was still a child of God. All right, so that's one thing. Another verb is that of tremble. Now, that's a word that means, well, as comes across in English, to shake in fear, to shake in dismay in response to God's goodness to his own, in spite of those enemies who are trying to discredit him. Now, he turns to the enemies and says, now you need to be doing the trembling. David, of course, had been trembling, but now it's their turn to tremble. And so he calls for them then to be shaken to the core so that they would stop rebelling. They needed to have a good scare put into them. And sometimes that's the only thing that will wake us up, is having a good scare. Now, it's Alan Ross who says what they were to do was to think carefully about their sins and let that quiet, sober reflection cause them to change their ways. So he calls upon them to meditate. Remember in Psalm 1, the godly meditate on the law of the Lord day and night. Well, then David is calling upon them to engage in that work of meditation, but to do so in such a way that they would come to understand that their end is going to be a sorry one if they don't turn and don't become as David himself with all of his problems. Well, we said it's in Ephesians 4:26 that Paul quotes the text, "Be angry, but do not sin." Now, Peter O'Brien, one of the commentators, puts it well, I think. It says, the psalmist, David, has been accused quite unjustly of some crime or sin, and though he knows he is innocent, the reproach of this hangs heavily upon him. God replaces the anger which resulted from the lies of others, that's in verse 2, giving him instead a heart full of joy and peace. So he, David, admonishes his hearers as he further consoles and strengthens himself not to sin in their anger. What Paul then urges of the new man, Ephesians 4:24, has already been foreshadowed by the psalmist's own experience. I think that's well said. Now, the third and fourth verbs go together. The one is ponder, and the other is to be silent. And so he's saying, effectively, ponder with your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Now, the idea, again, is that of meditating. He's turning to his enemies and saying, think about these things. Don't do anything for the moment. It's not time for action. It's time for thinking. It's time for pondering. Time for contemplating. And so they ought to do that. And by implication, he's saying, postpone any action you may have contemplated until you've thought it through. And that's very much what James says in chapter 1. Let everyone be quick to hear and slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not work the righteousness of God. And how easy it is to snap. How easy it is to fly off the handle. To be irritated, to be provoked, and the immediate thing you want to do is lash out in response. Like you want to get even. But James is quite clear that that kind of anger does not work God's righteousness. And notice that phrase, to work the righteousness of God, is something that we actually do. And so ponder and be silent, David says to his enemies. Then he says, offer right sacrifices. And quite literally, again in the Hebrew, it's offer sacrifices of righteousness. In other words, sacrifices that grow out of righteousness, that are the result of righteousness. And once again, righteousness is fidelity to the covenant, faithfulness to the covenant. And so offer that kind of a sacrifice. See, only sacrifices like that are true worship. Otherwise, you're just going through the motions. Now, no doubt David's enemies were offering sacrifice. because they were in the covenant, at least superficially. They were obliged to do that, but they were making unrighteous sacrifices. And there's a difference between the two, obviously. And those unrighteous sacrifices are simply unacceptable to God. You remember that passage in Hosea 6:6. I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Now your critics come along and say, well, you know, you have the Mosaic period, you have all this ritual, you have the sacrifice, you have doing everything by the book and by the law. But when you come to the prophets, they take a looser view of things. You don't really have to sacrifice. That's not important. It's more important that you think the right thing, feel the right thing. But, of course, that's pitting one element over against the other illegitimately. This is part of the prophetic way of speaking. It's the idea of using absolute language to convey a relative truth. And so everyone at that point in time ought to offer sacrifice, to be sure. But what's more important is the underlying attitude of steadfast love and the knowledge of God. That's what really matters. The sacrifices only symbolize those two very important things. And so that's what David's getting at. Then sacrifices of righteousness. It's interesting how in Matthew 9, that passage in Hosea is quoted. Matthew tells us that Christ was sitting at the table in the house, and the tax collectors and the sinners came to eat with him. And of course, that was not acceptable in the least. Because, well, what kind of individuals were the sinners generally? There are two groups that are singled out in the Gospels as being the arch sinners. Right. Yeah. Yeah, they were among the rich, that's right. And the other group would be? Well, prostitutes.
Right.
Right, so you have tax collectors and the prostitutes. Now, the taxman has always received a pretty bad name, and deservedly so for the most part. I think most of us can do without the taxman, but we're stuck with them. But, of course, in those days, what the Romans allowed them to do was collect what Rome required, and as much as they could get above and beyond that, they could keep for themselves. And so the taxes were exorbitantly high. And the Romans had a trick that if they wanted to take over your property, you didn't want to sell, well, they just raised the taxes so high that you had no choice. So you have the taxmen, then you have the prostitutes. And, of course, by the very nature of the case, they were in violation of the covenant because adultery was a symbol of unfaithfulness to God in the covenant. All right, so then you have these groups, and the Pharisees, when they see it, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? But when he heard it, he said, those who are well have no need of a physician, but only those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, from Hosea, for I came not to call the righteous, but sinners.
It's interesting that Jesus pointed out a totally different set of the two sinners.
He did, yes.
The scribes and the Pharisees.
Exactly so. That's role reversal.
Yeah.
An extreme example of it. Because they were the holy guys. They were the ones who kept not only the law as they perceived it, but they added their traditions to it. So it's the idea that if you don't want to fall into a hole in the ground, to a well, then you build a fence around it. And so they had their fence, but it's precisely their fence which was a violation of Scripture itself. Then it's fine before we finish this morning. David says, put your trust in the Lord. Now, to trust, of course, means to put our complete confidence in the Lord. Because he is the one who is able to deliver all of those who call to him. And without trust, faith is incomplete. There's such a thing as fideism. You nod your head in assent to a set of propositions, you know. And you're orthodox, you're fine and all of that. But you can do that without actually having the trust that is involved in faith. And so David calls on his enemies to exercise real faith, which always results in faithfulness. So they're the important people. They're the important guys. They need to renounce their self-confidence. They need to become genuine members of the covenant, not just those who live in the land of Israel. And another way you could put it is that even though they are the rich, they need to become the poor. That is, they need to become true Israelites, those who have renounced their confidence in anything else except the Lord Himself. Okay, anything else we can take up? This is a good place to stop for this one. Thank you.